telling her what? Jesse demanded.
"'Tis not of your concern. Stay the bloody hell out of it.
Kian snarled at Dagus.
Nay, not after what transpired between the two of you last eve. She has a right to know. Either you tell her, or I will. 'Tis the only mercy I'll grant.
Kian?
Jesse implored questioningly. He gazed at her a long, silent moment. A muscle in his jaw leapt. He turned abruptly in the mirror, and disappeared into the silver. It rippled behind him and went flat. Jesse stared at the looking glass in disbelief. What could be so terrible that, after the incredible intimacy they'd just shared, he would turn his back on her and walk away?
What's going on?
She turned a plaintive gaze on Dagus. There was a sinking sensation in the pit of her stomach, and she knew, just knew, she was about to hear something that was going to make her wish she'd cut her ears off instead. When Jesse heard Kian murmur a short chant, she knew what was coming, and a cry of alarm escaped her. The jeweled blade that had slain the room service assassin whipped out of the glass and lodged in a wall, behind and a hair's breadth to the left of Dagus's temple.
"Sooner answer her, you bastard!"
came the savage growl from the silvery glass.
"Harm any of mine, and I'll break your blethering mirror,"
Drustin said very, very quietly.
"Were I not certain you missed deliberately, I'd have done it already."
Another savage sound rumbled within the mirror, rattling the glass in its frame.
"What?"
Jesse repeated weakly.
"Tell me what?"
Dagus sighed, his chiseled features grim.
"All Tuahade bindings, lass, whether seely compacts or unseely indentures, must be periodically reaffirmed by gold. The Keltar compact, for example, was forged in purest gold, and need only be reaffirmed if something within it is changed, or if 'tis violated by a party to the agreement. But dark arts run counter to the nature of things, and require higher and more frequent tithes. As Kian said, the dark glass must be paid every 100 years on the anniversary of the original date of binding, at midnight."
Sorrowful gold eyes locked with hers, and that sinking sensation became a pit of acid in her stomach.
"Kian was bound on Samhain, lass. If the tithe is not paid by he who initiated the indenture, in this instance, Lucan, at precisely midnight on October 31st, the indenture will be violated, and all the years that Kian and Lucan have lived that were not theirs to live will be called due. At once. In a single moment."
Silence blanketed the room. It lay there, heavy, suffocating.
"What are you saying?"
Jesse stammered.
"You know what I'm saying, Jessica,"
Dagus said gently.
"Kian came back to Scotland for one reason. To die. That's his vengeance. That's his way of keeping Lucan from getting the dark book, and ending things once and for all. When the tithe is not paid, they will both die. It's all over. The immortal sorcerer will be slain without so much as a drop of blood spilled. All Kian must do is stay out of Lucan's hands until 12:01 on November 1st. And he's right. 'Tis truly the simplest, most effective way to end it. Quite tidy indeed. Drustin and I can then track down the dark book and attempt to either restore it to its guardians or protect it ourselves."
Jesse gaped at Dagus. Abruptly, everything Kian had told her since they'd met, and she now realized it was precious little, tumbled through her mind, and she apprehended it all in a vastly different light. She shook her head, pressing a hand to her mouth. Now that she knew the truth, it fit together so neatly that she was stunned that she'd not guessed at it before. Not once had he ever spoken of any moment beyond his deadline. Not even when she'd asked what he intended to do once the spell was broken. There'd never been a, "God, it'll be so good to be free again." There'd never been any mention of something he might like to do once he'd killed Lucan. maybe see a movie, have a feast, travel the world and stretch his legs a bit. In fact, there'd never even been any mention of him killing Lucan at all. And why would there have been? He'd never planned to actually physically kill him.
No new beginnings, he'd said. He'd known all along he wasn't going to be free in 15 days. He was going to be dead in 15 days.
Precisely 2 weeks and 1 day from today, Kian McKelter, the man with whom she'd just spent the most amazing, scorchingly passionate, dazzling night of her life, was going to be no more than a 1,163-year-old pile of dust. She turned numbly toward the mirror. Her own horrified reflection looked back at her. Kian was nowhere to be seen. The coward. Her face was pale, her eyes enormous.
"Oh, you son of a bitch," she breathed,
right before she burst into tears. Quod not cogit amor. Is there anything love couldn't make us do? Marshall, C.E., circa 40-104. Chapter 23. Jesse stood at the open window of the Silver Chamber, staring down through the dreary day at the misty castle grounds. Kian was striding across the vast, manicured expanse of front lawn. He'd removed the braids from his hair, and it was slicked wetly back from his regal face in a long, dark fall. The sky was leaden, the horizon of mountains obscured by dark thunderheads. A light, drizzling rain was falling, and patches of fog clung, here and there, to damp thatches of grass, gusting in drowsy, dreamy swirls as Kian sliced through them. He was wearing only a plaid, slung low around his hips, and soft leather boots, despite the chill in the air. He looked like a magnificent, half-savage 9th-century Highland laird out surveying his mountain domain. God, he was beautiful. He was bleeding. Blood trickled down his rain-slicked chest, slipped between the ridges of muscles in that sculpted stomach that, only the night before last, she'd tasted with her tongue, covered with kisses. Freshly dyed tattoos covered the right side of his chest and part of his right arm, the tiny needle pricks still beading with a wet sheen of blood. More mystic runes climbed up over his right shoulder, and as he turned down a cobbled stone walkway, she could see that either he or one of the twins had branded a fair portion of his back crimson and black as well. Protection runes.
"They hold the repercussions of meddling with black magics at bay,"
Chloe had said. She was so absorbed in watching him that she didn't hear the door to the bedchamber open and someone slip in, until Gwyn said softly,
"He's transmuting the soil, Jesse. He saw you up here and sent me to find you. He asked me to ask you not to watch." "Why?"
Jesse said tonelessly. Gwyn drew a deep breath and exhaled slowly.
"It's dark magic, Jesse. It has some ghastly side effects, but even Drustin agreed that it was necessary, and believe me, if Drustin agrees to any kind of dark magic or alchemy being used on Keltar land, there's a really good reason for it."
A faint, bitter smile curved Jesse's lips. There was so much love and pride in Gwyn's voice for her husband. She knew she would have felt the same about Kian in time, if she'd been given the time. But he'd never had any intention of giving her more than a few weeks from the very first.
"It will neutralize Lucan's powers if he comes here," Gwyn told her. "And Kian is convinced he will." "If that bastard comes here, can we kill him?"
Jesse said fiercely.
"If the wards have neutralized him?" "No. The glass keeps him immortal, just like Kian, Jesse. He can't be killed. The wards will only inhibit his use of sorcery on Keltar land. He won't be able to work spells, and he won't be able to enter the castle proper. Kian is doing the most intense warding around the perimeter of the castle walls. It's why he wants you not to watch. Apparently, if anything is dead within the castle grounds, his wards will raise it until he, well, inters it again with a ritual burial somewhere else." "Let me guess. Without his protection runes, those reanimated dead things might turn on him. He didn't say, but that's kind of what I guessed, too. And in Scottish soil, God only knows where people and things are buried. The country's had quite the turbulent past.
Jesse shivered and fell silent again. Sorcerers, spells, and now dead things walking. She shook her head. How strange and terrible her life had become. In the past 48 hours, she'd soared to the greatest heights she'd ever known, only to plummet into the deepest abyss. She'd been blissfully, idiotically thinking she'd found her soulmate, only to discover that said soulmate was not only going to die in 2 weeks' time, but she was going to be forced to occupy a front-row seat to the spectacle. Dagus and Drustin had confined her to the castle. She was not allowed to leave unless and until they said otherwise. They believed that if she left, Lucan would either try to use her to get to Kian. Frankly, she wasn't sure he'd care. Why care about her body when he'd not cared about her heart? Or kill her outright if he got his hands on her? She bought into the killing her outright part, which meant she had to stay put if she wanted to survive. Which meant she had to watch her Highlander die.
Dagus and Drustin are trying to find another way, Jesse,
Gwyn said softly.
Some alternative to get Kian out of the glass and defeat Lucan. If Kian knows of no way, then do you really think they'll be able to find one? Nothing against your husband and his brother, but Kian is the only one here that seems to know anything about sorcery. You can't give up hope, Jesse. Why not? Kian did,
she said bitterly.
He's ready to die.
Gwyn sucked in a breath.
It's the only way he knows to stop Lucan, Jesse. At least right now it is. Let my husband and Dagus work on it. You'd be amazed at what the two of them can accomplish. But don't hate Kian for this. Oh, he was wrong not to tell you. You'll get no argument from me there. I'd be devastated, too. And furious, and hurt. And devastated, and furious, and hurt all over again. But I think you need to ponder why he didn't tell you. And think about this, too. You're 20-something years old, right?
Jesse nodded. Below her, Kian was entering a small copse of rowan trees, moving with sleekly muscled animal grace through gossamer milky white tendrils of fog.
24. Well, he's lived, let's see, 47.16 times that long, almost 50 times as long as you have, trapped inside a looking glass, living not even a mere reflection of a life. For more than 1,000 years he's been by himself, imprisoned, powerless. He told us a bit last night after supper while you were sleeping. He has no physical needs in there. He has had nothing with which to pass the time. Lucan never gave him any word of his clan once he'd incarcerated him. He'd believed for the past millennium that Lucan had wiped out his entire family, that the Keltar line had been destroyed. It's why he never thought of looking for any descendants, why it didn't occur to him that Dagus might be a Keltar when they met. The only companion he had in the mirror with him was his bitter regret and his determination to kill Lucan one day. The opportunity finally presented itself. Is it really a wonder to you that he might be willing to die to take down his enemy, rather than continue living in such a hellish fashion? It's a wonder to me that the man didn't go insane centuries ago.
Tears burned the backs of Jesse's eyes, and she'd thought she'd cried herself out yesterday. She'd wondered the same thing, how he'd stayed sane. But then she'd realized he was a mountain. Yesterday had been the most awful day of her life. If she could have collected together all the tears she'd ever cried, beginning with that first wailed protest at the shock of being born, through childhood pains, adolescent indignities, and womanly hurts, they'd not have made a drop in the bucket of tears she'd wept yesterday. When Dagus had explained to her what Kian meant to do, she'd raced from the library as fast as her feet had been able to take her. She'd tried to flee the castle as well, but Dagus had caught up with her and stopped her, gently rerouting her upstairs to the chamber they'd readied for her. She'd locked herself in and collapsed across the bed, weeping. Eventually, she'd sobbed herself into a deep, exhausted sleep. The worst of it was, the whole time she'd been crying, hating him for making her care about him, knowing he was going to die and not telling her. Every ounce of her had nonetheless ached to go back downstairs and sit as close to his damned mirror as she could possibly get, to regain that intense, tender intimacy they'd just shared, to touch the glass if she couldn't touch him, to settle for anything at all, to beg for crumbs. She'd thought of what Gwen had said herself yesterday. She'd had the occasional lucid moments in her self-pitying and furious delirium. Yes, of course she could see how he would not just be willing to die, but might actually be ready to embrace death after an eternity in a cold stone hell all by himself. Understanding didn't make it any better. She'd read once, in one of those magazines like Woman's Day or Reader's Digest, about a nurse who'd fallen in love with one of her terminal patients, a man who had no more than 10 or 12 months left to live from some disease or other. The article hadn't been her cup of tea, but she'd gotten sucked into it, victim of the same morbid fascination that made rubberneckers of people passing the scene of a gruesome car wreck, splashed with blood and strewn with body bags. She'd thought how incredibly stupid the nurse had been to let it happen. She should have transferred his case to someone else the moment she'd started liking him and fallen in love with a different man. At least the nurse had gotten nearly a year. Her terminal patient had a mere 14 days.
"Go away, please,"
Jessie said.
"Jessie, I know we don't know each other very well. You're right, Gwen, we don't. So please just leave me alone for a while. You can tell him I won't watch, I promise."
And she meant it. She would respect his wishes. Moving woodenly, she closed the window, flipped the latch, and let the heavy damask drape fall over the mullioned panes. There was silence behind her.
"Please go, Gwen."
A few moments later there was a gusty sigh, then the chamber door clicked softly shut. Lucan threaded his fingers through his hair, smoothing it back from his temples. His palms were hot, the flesh singed, his nails blackened. No matter. In a moment, the lingering traces of Hans's misfortune would be gone. He stepped over the charred body dispassionately. It smelled and needed to be removed from the pub. Wending his way through the posh paneled bar with its high-backed wooden booths cushioned in tufted leather upholstery, Lucan murmured a series of spells beneath his breath, concealing from the pub's animated patrons both the man he'd just scorched to a cinder and his true appearance. Centuries ago, tattoos had taken what remained of his face, including his ears, eyelids, lips, and tongue, making him far too memorable to observers. Even his nails had been removed and tattooed beneath. His eyes had changed shortly after he'd finished scoring the final black and crimson brands inside his nose. He'd seeded his dick and testicles long before his tongue. His eyelids in advance of those sensitive inner nasal mucous membranes, though by then he'd suffered no pain. People often had a strongly unfavorable reaction to the face of a sorcerer. He shouldn't have agreed to meet Hans in a pub. Lately, several of his employees had displayed a preference for public meeting places, as if that made any difference. Kian McKelter had indeed returned to the Highlands, as Lucan had known he would. The bastard wanted to die in Scotland, as Lucan had known he would. According to his late employee, the castle the 9th-century Highlander had once lived in was now occupied by Christopher and Maggie McKeltar and their children. But it was not that castle and its occupants that concerned him. It was the other one, the one he'd not known existed. A second castle had been constructed on a distant part of the McKeltar estate at some time during the 16th century, years after he'd quit paying attention to that rocky, barbaric little corner of the Highlands. It was currently occupied by twin Keltar males, with old names, Dagus and Drustan. Who the fuck were they, and from beneath what fucking rock had they crawled? It was in that castle, or so Hans had suspected, that the mirror was being kept. A man and a woman fitting Kian and Jesse St. James's description had been seen in a store in Inverness. There Hans had encountered the confusion typical of the after-effects of voice, but he'd managed to obtain the information that a heretofore unknown Keltar, one of the twins, Dagus, had driven off in a vehicle with a large, ornate mirror in the back of it. The employee had recalled the mirror because that tattooed guy had been obsessive about it not getting broken, rearranging it 3 times and padding it with blankets before permitting other items to be loaded in with it. Lucan had not anticipated this. He'd expected Kian to head for the hills, to be in the wide open. He'd expected to be facing 1 McKelter, not 3. 2 of them complete unknowns. In a castle that was probably warded to the fucking rafters. He frowned over his shoulder at the crisply blackened remains of Hans. It would remain concealed by his spell for a few moments more. Then 1 pubgoer or another would take note of the grisly corpse on the floor. Women would scream, and men would mill about, gaping, readying their stories for water cooler chats in the morning. Law enforcement would be rung. Lucan quickened his pace, pushing his way through the boisterous after-work crowd. It was damned inconvenient for Hans to be dead right now. There were other matters to which Lucan would have liked him to attend. He'd not killed him. Oh no, not he. He'd brooked no quarrel with Hans. The power within him was occasionally wont to act with a will of its own. It was part of being such a great sorcerer. The vessel of his tattooed body was no longer sufficient to completely contain his greatness. Magic sometimes overflowed, leaked out, and someone got burned. Literally. Lucan chuckled dryly. Surely he was the greater sorcerer by now. 14 days. His crimson eyes lit with mirth, and he was taken by a sharp bark of laughter, struck by the sheer absurdity of the thought that he, Lucan Merthyn Trevane, could die. Impossible. As he quit the pub and stepped into the chilly London evening, he considered his next step. A cry of shock and horror chased him through the closing tavern door into the drizzly night beyond. He would return to his residence and take another stab at securing a connection with the St. James woman. He'd been attempting regularly to reach her again, but either she was not logging into her account, or he was missing those windows of opportunity when she was. Women were weak links. There was always something in them begging to be exploited. He just had to find it. Exploit it. He would punish the Keltar for this, wasting his time, taking him away from his true purpose, his destiny. Only this morning, an unusual man with long coppery hair and shimmering copper eyes had sought him out, claiming to have knowledge of the ciphers in which the dark book was written. The man had dripped a deep-seated arrogance that could only have been born of some kind of power. Either his own, or close association with someone who made him feel fearless. Lucan's first instinct had been to eliminate the man. From time to time an apprentice petitioned mentoring, or a rival sorcerer dispatched a spy. Lucan never suffered such fools to live. He didn't trust anyone who'd managed to learn of him, penetrate the layers of his many identities, and locate him. But then the man had told him he'd actually lived among the Fae for a time. He'd been familiar with the runes on the Hallows, and he'd spoken a tongue he'd alleged was that of the Tuatha De themselves. He'd also displayed an intimate knowledge of the Seelie and Unseelie courts. It had been enough to stay Lucan's hand. Whoever, whatever the man was, he needed him alive until he'd stripped from him what knowledge he possessed. It took time to perform a ruthless deep probing. And until the dark glass was secured, such critical matters had to be suspended. He'd been forced to allow the man to leave, telling him he'd get in touch. Oh yes, Kian would be punished. For delaying his plans, wasting his time, and tying up his resources at such a crucial hour. The men Hans had been searching with in the Highlands, those who'd been watching the airports, and others he'd been preparing to ward around the Highlander when he found him, if necessary. All were men who could have been following the latest lead on the Dark Book. He wondered how the arrogant Keltar would like spending the next 1,000 years hung in a deep, dark cavern, flush to a stone wall. He'd only kept the mirror in his study for the amusement it had given, and because, on occasion, he'd needed his captive to perform some deed he'd not yet possessed the power to do himself. But once he had the Dark Book, he would never need the druid again. And then Kian McKelter was going to rot in the deepest, coldest, blackest hell Lucan could find for him. Chapter 24. Under ideal circumstances, Jessie might have spent days brooding, weeks even. When she was hurt, she preferred to hole up and lick her wounds alone. But circumstances were far from ideal, and days were precisely what she didn't have. As for weeks, she had two, period. By the time she finished licking wounds, she would have a much bigger one to tend. And then she would despise herself for time wasted. Kian had either finished placing his wards, or the mirror had reclaimed him again. She knew because a little while ago she'd heard people out on the lawn, laughing and talking. She'd pushed aside the drapes to find diffident rays of late afternoon sunlight trying to push through thick gray clouds and several castle maids standing about, hands on hips, eyes sparkling, flirting with a handful of well-muscled gardeners who were trimming hedges on the still damp lawn. She'd been startled to realize how late in the day it was. She'd passed most of it staring into space, trying to mull through thoughts hopelessly muddied by emotions, and decide if Kian was a callous bastard who just wanted to have sex before he, insert word she refused to say even in her mind, or if he cared for her at all. She could argue the case both ways.
"You fit me here, woman," he'd said.
And when she remembered him saying those words, and the look on his face as he'd said them, she believed him. Especially when she remembered it, coupled with the way he'd made love to her in front of the fire, and again later in the shower. She could have sworn she'd felt a part of him bleeding into her through his hands, that he'd been cherishing every last cell of her being with his caresses. Yet there was a cynical part of her that said a dying man after a millennia-old blood vengeance might say just about anything to get, A, somewhere safe so he could have his vengeance, and B, hey, how about a little great sex along the way with the big-boobed babe? Bottom line was, the big-boobed babe had finally realized that she wasn't going to get anywhere sitting in her room alone, groping blindly through her thoughts. So she decided to go find him, and grope blindly through his thoughts, assuming he would cooperate, and see what might come of it. It ended up being far more than his thoughts she groped. Kian stood in the library, near the fire, and finished plaiting the last of the braids into his hair. He slipped the remaining tri-colored bead around it, compressing the soft metal between his finger and thumb, molding it to the end. A sorcerer did not risk any other elements on his body when working dark alchemy. He gathered his arm cuffs from the mantle and refastened them around his wrists. The warding was now complete. The castle grounds protected. There hadn't been as many dead things in the soil as he'd expected, likely due to the lesser, ancient wards he discovered and removed before sowing his own. Keltar's soil was clean earth, strong and potent. His wards had intensified that potency to a nearly palpable degree. Indeed, as he'd walked over it, returning to the castle proper, he'd felt the power of his wards humming beneath his heels. None of Lucan's sorcery would be of any avail to him on the castle proper portion of the estate now. Upon completing his task, he'd washed up and hurried to the library to advise his descendants that the job was done. He'd found the twins and their wives cozied up to a crackling fire. There was not a single place he could look in the book-lined room that did not bring to mind intoxicatingly sensual, carnal memories of his night with Jessica. Their bodies had come together with every bit of the explosive passion he'd known they would. The entire time he'd been laying wards, he'd kept his thoughts tightly focused on the task at hand. But now they burst free of his tight rein and turned hungrily, desperately to his woman.
"How is she?"
he asked. It was Gwyn who answered.
"Furious. Hurt. And hurt and furious,"
Chloe added.
"What did you expect?"
Drustin said stiffly.
"You seduce her and do not tell her you're dying? Have you no honor, kinsman?"
Kian said nothing. He'd not explain himself to Drustin, nor to any man. Only one woman's opinion of him mattered, and even that wouldn't have stopped him. He'd done what he'd done and didn't wish it undone. Undone, he'd not have gotten his knight. And though Jessica may think him a thousand kinds of bastard, he would have another knight with her, and another still. As many knights as he could beg, borrow, or steal from her until he was naught but dust blowing on a dark Scots wind.
Where is she?
The mirror still hadn't reclaimed him. It had been imperative he lay the warding, but now that 'twas done, he wasn't about to fritter away another precious moment of his time free of the glass. As Gwen opened her mouth to reply, the library door eased open, and Jessica poked her head in. Her broody, jade gaze fixed on Gwen. She didn't see Kian at first. Faded blue jeans cased those sexy legs that had so recently been wrapped around his ass, her ankles locked in the small of his back while he'd pounded into her. They hugged low on her hips, revealing the creamy, sun-kissed skin of her belly, upon which he'd spilled drops of his seed. A soft, dainty, lacy, woven pale green sweater was buttoned over her heavy, round breasts. It seemed an eternity since he'd touched her.
I was wondering where... Oh!
The words died on her tongue when she saw him.
There you are.
Kian assessed her with the instincts of a hunter born for the kill. He'd slammed up against that sleek, cool wall inside her skull so many times, he no longer bothered trying to read her that way. He read her body instead. So that was the way of it. The same way it was for him. Mindless, thoughtless need. It had her by the balls, too, so to speak. He devoured the space between them in a few aggressive strides. Her eyes widened. She wet her lips and they parted, not in protest, but in instinctive preparation. Her eyes dilated, her legs moved slightly apart, her breasts lifted. Christ, he felt just the same way. He saw her. He needed her. He closed a hand on her shoulder, opened the door, backed her out into the corridor, and yanked the door shut behind them, dispensing with the McKeltar with a single slam. Just like that, they ceased to exist. There was only Jessica. The corridor was long, high-ceilinged, lit by pale yellow wall torches and the fiery glow of a crimson sun sinking beyond tall mullioned windows. He backed her across the hall, pushing her up against the wall. He could feel the heat rolling off her, knew it was coming off him, too. He could smell her arousal, could smell his own. What was between them was quite simply a force of nature. As she hit stone, she gritted with a little oomph of breath.
You son of a bitch!
You said that yesterday. I heard you then.
If he'd had enough time, like a lifetime, to do things differently, he'd never have given her a reason to call him such a thing. If only he'd met her when he'd been but a score of years, or nay, if they'd been betrothed at birth, grown up together, hand in hand in the Highlands, his life would have been so different. He would have been a deeply contented man, and on that snowy night Lucan had knocked, he'd have been in bed with his wife, with a babe or two nearby. A sorcerer's spells and enchantments would have held no lure for him. Nothing would have, not beyond this woman. He would never have accompanied Trevane to Ireland, would never have ridden beside him for Capscorth on a sweet spring day, only to usher in the night with the blood of an entire village on his hands.
You ruthless bastard!
I know.
There was no denying it. What he'd done was wrong. He should have told her from the beginning. He should have given her the choice to decide whether she was willing to give any part of herself to a man condemned to die.
You heartless prick!
Aye, woman. All that, and more.
He'd known who she was all along. He'd known from the moment he'd first laid a hand on her, back there in the office of her university, when he'd swept her behind him to protect her from Roman. He'd felt it right then in the marrow of his bones. That thing he'd waited so damned long to feel, that had never come. He'd thought 30 years so unbearably long to wait. He'd never have imagined it might take him 1,133 more years to find her, and then he'd only get 20 days into which he'd have to cram a lifetime. Ach, aye, he'd felt it that night. His hand had closed on her upper arm, and his entire being had hissed a single, silent word.
Mine.
He'd blinded himself to the truth, all the while determinedly pursuing her, because if, at any moment, he'd admitted she was his one true mate, he might have wavered in his resolve. And he was a man who never wavered. He decided. He committed. He paid for what he purchased. For this sin, he had no doubt he would pay with his soul, and consider it worth it.
I can't believe you lied to me!
I know.
Knowing she was his mate, knowing she would live on after him, and undoubtedly find a husband and make a family with some other man, he'd tried to burn himself into her, to conquer some small corner of her heart. He was supposed to have been her man. He was supposed to have been the father of her children, not some 21st-century asshole that would touch her breasts and kiss her soft mouth and fill her up and never be good enough for her. Not that he was good enough for her. Still, it was supposed to have been him.
I hate you for this!
He flinched, hating those words.
I know.
So what the hell do you have to say for yourself?
He clamped her face between his hands and stared into her eyes.
14 days,
he hissed.
'Tis all I've left. What would you have of me? Apologies? Self-recrimination? You'll get none.
Why?
She cried, tears springing to her eyes.
Because I knew the moment I saw you.
He ground out savagely, her "I hate you" still ringing in his ears.
That in another life, a life where I didn't become a dark sorcerer, you were my wife. I cherished you. I adored you. I loved you until the end of time, Jessica McElter. But I don't get to have that life. So I'll take you any fucking way I can get you, and I'll not apologize for one moment of it.
She went motionless in his arms. She stared up at him, her lovely green eyes wide.
You loved me?
He inhaled sharply.
I...
Staring down at her, something in him melted.
Oh, lass,
he relented.
I will rue for all eternity every moment of suffering I've caused you. The entire time I'm burning in hell, I'll regret each tear I made you weep. But if hell were the price for 20 days with you, I'd condemn myself again and again.
She sagged back against the wall, her lashes fluttering down, her eyes closing. He waited, watching her, committing every last cell of her face to his memory. From her tousled raven curls to her thick dark lashes staining sooty crescents on her cheeks, glistening with a sheen of unshed tears, to her dainty crooked nose, to her luscious soft lips, to the stubborn thrust of her chin. He was going to die remembering it. He felt as if he'd been born already knowing her face, that he'd been watching, always waiting to see it coming at him from just around the next corner. But it hadn't come, and he'd stopped believing in the Keltar legends of a true mate. And he strayed into dark magics.
Mine,
he whispered fiercely, looking down at her. Her eyes fluttered open then. In their jade depths he saw pain, rawness and grief, but he also saw understanding.
You know what the sad thing is?
She said softly. He shook his head.
I think that if you'd told me the truth from the beginning, I'd have just slept with you sooner.
He winced as time lost never to be regained sliced like a knife through his heart. Then he realized that she'd just granted him an absolution he could never deserve. She'd said, "Even knowing, I would have anyway." Wee woman, heart of a warrior.
So take me, Kian. Take me as many times as you can.
Her voice broke on the next words.
Because no matter how many times we get to have, it's not going to be enough.
I know, love. I know,
he said roughly. He wasted no more time. He took her. Cupping her face between his big hands, he kissed her, sliding his hot, velvety tongue deep. Threading his fingers into her silky curls, he cradled her head delicately, tipping her at just the right angle. Jesse melted against him.
You were my wife, he'd said. I loved you until the end of time. Jessica McElter,
he'd called her, as if he really had married her in another life. She'd wanted such words. She'd neither expected nor been prepared for them. The moment he'd said them, she realized that it would have been kinder if he'd not said them at all, if he'd let her think him a callous prick, let her hate him. But his words would keep her from ever being able to hate him. They'd ripped her open, ruthlessly exposing her heart. Her anger had dropped away as if it had never been, leaving only a desperation akin to his, to have whatever she could have of him for so long as she could have it. Because she felt it too, as if they were supposed to have made a direct hit, to have had a full, long, crazy, wild, passion-filled, child-strewn life together. But somehow they'd come at each other from the wrong angle, and missed what could have, would have, should have been. If she thought about it, it would tear her into little pieces. She refused to drown in sorrow. She would drown instead in the exquisiteness of this moment. There would be time for grief later. Too much time. A freaking lifetime. But now her man was kissing her. Now his powerful hands were hot on her bare skin, slipping beneath her sweater. Now he was gripping her by the waist and lifting her against him. She wrapped her legs around him and locked her ankles behind his back as he backed her into the wall, kissing her passionately. She had now, and she wasn't going to waste a single precious moment of it. Gwen smiled over her shoulder at Drustin as he followed her to the door. Shortly after their ninth-century ancestor had risen without a word and stalked from the room with Jesse, Gwen had realized it was nearly dinner time, and a good thing, too, as she'd completely forgotten lunch in all the fuss today, and her stomach was growling hungrily. But upon Kian's departure, Dagus and Drustin had promptly gotten into a heated discussion about him. It had taken her a good 10 minutes to regain their attention and propose they move their conversation to the dining room. Now opening the door, she began to step out into the corridor.
"Oh, my," she said faintly.
She retreated right back into the library and gently closed the door.
Why don't we just, stay here in the library for a little while? Who wants to play Pente?"
she said brightly.
"I'm not as hungry as I thought I was."
She turned and butted nose to ribs with Drustin. He caught her by the shoulders.
"Why, lass? Is aught amiss? What's out there?"
Drustin stepped back, staring down at her, perplexed.
"Nothing. Nothing at all."
He raised a dark, slanted brow.
"Well then, let's be off."
"Oh no, not just yet."
She beamed up at him. Backing herself flush to the door, she draped herself casually against it.
"Let's stay here. Another half hour or so should be, just about right."
She blinked, looking uncertain.
"I hope."
Drustin cocked his head, studied her a moment, then began to reach behind her for the doorknob. Gwen sighed.
Don't, Drustin. We can't leave just yet. Kian and Jesse are out there."
"Out there?"
Drustin said blankly, stopping mid-reach.
"So? Will we not fit past them in the corridor?"
"I'm sure we could if we tried. I'm not sure we'd want to,"
Gwen said meaningfully. He regarded her expectantly. She tried again.
"You know, there, out there."
Drustin continued to regard her expectantly.
"Oh, Gwen,"
Chloe cooed excitedly.
"Do you mean out there?"
Gwen nodded.
"Ha!"
Chloe exclaimed.
"I knew that woman wasn't stupid."
"Wait a minute. They're out there?"
Dagus said disbelievingly.
"The two of them are out there in the corridor?
I put over 100 rooms in this castle, and they are bloody out there in the bloody corridor as if they couldn't find a door to a chamber. 'Tis not as if I concealed them. There's only one every few bloody paces or so. Is it so much effort to turn a doorknob? A muscle leapt in Drustin's jaw. His eyes narrowed.
Lass, are you telling me that Kian and Jessica are tooping in that corridor? Is that why you closed that door?
Blushing, she nodded.
You saw this? Nay, that was a stupid question. Of course you did. What exactly did you see, lass?
Me? Oh, nothing.
She folded her arms over her chest and stared off at a point somewhere east of his elbow.
Gwendolyn?
He crossed his arms and waited.
Okay, so maybe I saw little,
Gwyn admitted.
But he has her up against the wall, and all I saw was his butt, and I closed my eyes the minute I saw it.
You saw my ancestor's arse?
Drustin said frostily.
His bare arse? Had the man any clothing on at all?
He began reaching past her again for the doorknob. She waved his hand away.
Oh, for heaven's sake, Drustin, you saw him when he left. All he had on to begin with was his plaid. What do you think?
Drustin's nostrils flared.
I think the man's a blethering savage.
Aye,
Degas agreed.
Oh, you two should talk,
Chloe said, laughing.
And Degas, need I remind you of some of the places you and I...
Case argued and won, lass,
he said hastily.
I hardly saw a thing,
Gwyn assured Drustin.
It's not like I held the door open and stared or anything, even though he is a McKelter.
She blinked.
And he certainly was every inch a Mc...
She broke off hastily, looking abashed, and feigned a sudden fascination with her cuticles.
What I meant was just that you McKelters are a fine-looking lot of men, Drustin, and he is related to you. Actually, he precedes you in the gene pool, which might explain... Oh, dear, I should probably just shut up now, shouldn't I?
She pressed her lips together.
That seals it, Drustin said calmly. I'm going to have to kill the man.
It was Degas who put things back into perspective.
You dunna mean that, Drustin. Nor could you if you did. So long as he's bound to the mirror, he can't be killed. But dunna flash yourself. The poor bastard will be dead in a fortnight anyway, and he'll ne'er tup his mate in our corridor again.
Drustin winced, and a bleak expression entered his eyes. He stared down at Gwyn a moment, then gathered her gently in his arms and held her. Degas pulled his wife close as well, remembering a time when he'd not believed he had much more time with his mate himself. Half an hour later, it was a somber foursome that peeped cautiously out into the corridor before attempting to go to dinner again. Jessie awoke late at night, alone, in a bedchamber. She and Kian had eventually become cognizant of where they were, and just how public it was, and had stumbled from the corridor into a nearby bedchamber. She stirred in the great big down-filled canopied bed, nestled in a warm mound of velvety blankets. She pushed a hand through her wrecked curls. She didn't need to see a mirror to know she had major bedhead. At the edges of her consciousness, a terrible reality knocked, seeking entrance to her thoughts, but she refused to grant it an audience. Now was now. Later would come soon enough. She smiled. She'd fallen asleep in bed with her Highlander's strong arms wrapped around her, spooning her backside to his front side, with one of his powerful legs draped over hers. A perfect memory. She committed it to a special corner of her mind, where each moment she had with him would be immortalized. These memories she would make with him now would have to last her a lifetime. She pushed herself up and slipped from the bed, dropping barefoot onto the floor. She dressed swiftly and hurried for the door, wanting to be with him every possible moment. But when she ducked her head into the dimly lit library, the castle had been put to bed along with its occupants hours ago. The mirror wasn't where she'd last seen it, and a stab of blind panic made her chest feel dangerously tight.
We moved it, lass.
A soft voice cut through the darkness. She jumped, peering into the dim room. By the soft red glow of the embers of a dying fire, she could make out a man's shape in an armchair near the hearth. Stacks of books surrounded him on both sides, and he was paging through another.
Drustin? Dagus?
By voice alone, she couldn't tell them apart.
"'Tis Dagus, lass. Why can't I deep-read you, Jessica?"
Jessie shrugged.
"'I think it's because I was injured when I was young and I have a metal plate in my head. When Kian uses his voice spell on other people, it feels itchy inside my skull."
He was silent a moment, then snorted with laughter.
"Oh, 'tis too perfect. 'Tis also exactly what it feels like, a smooth, cold, hard barrier. It must shield you from magic somehow. You said other people. Has he ever tried to use voice on you?"
"Yes," she said. "It doesn't work."
Dagus gave another soft laugh.
"Despite how bloody powerful he is, Kian can't deep listen to you either, can he?"
"I don't think so. He told me none of his magic works on me."
"Good," he said slowly. "That's very good."
She thought that an odd thing to say, and began to press, but he spoke again swiftly.
"Are you all right, Jessica?"
She shrugged again. What could she possibly say?
"I'm both happier and more alive than I've ever been, and I feel like I'm dying too. And I suspect before this is over I'll wish I was."
She said instead,
"Where is the mirror?"
"We moved it to the Great Hall at his request. When I built this castle, I buried 4 ward stones beneath the entry, east, west, north, and south. They are massive stones, and I spelled them myself. He sensed their potency and asked that the mirror be hung on the landing of the stairs. 'Twill grant him the greatest protection. He is determined Lucan not be able to reach the dark glass."
He paused, and she had the sense Dagus was not pleased with his ancestor.
"He will have his vengeance, lass, no matter the cost."
She already knew that, and was in no mood to discuss it. There was a bitter stew bubbling inside her, but she was not yet ready to ladle deep down into it. She would taste the richness first. She nodded briskly.
"Thank you."
She slipped from the library. 20 minutes later, Jessie had what she needed. While she spread the comforters and throws and pillows at the base of the mirror on the wide expanse of landing in the Great Hall, Kian stood framed in the mirror, watching her every move. When she was cozily scrunched into the blankets, curled up on her side, facing the mirror, she smiled drowsily up at him.
"Good night, Kian."
"Good night, Jessica. Dream sweet, lass."
"You too."
He was kind enough not to remind her that he neither slept nor dreamed while in the mirror. And Jessica made a sleepy entry in a mental diary.
"Memory, day 14. We said good night tonight like a married couple who'd been together for years and years."
So what if he was in a mirror and she was sleeping on the floor? It was still a fine memory. Chapter 25. Days sped by on winged feet. Jessie'd always thought that was such a cliché. Time speeding by on winged feet. Time flies when you're having fun. Or as Kian had once put it so simply, time is of the veriest essence. Yes, it was. Suddenly all the clichés in the world were true. Each and every one made perfect sense to her. Those love songs on the radio that had once made her roll her eyes and tune the dial to Godsmack instead now reduced her to sappy sentimentality in moments. She'd even caught herself humming the maudlin melody of a country music song the other day, and she'd never liked country music. Last year she'd read The Stranger by Albert Camus in French for extra foreign language credits. Not her cup of tea, though it had given her food for thought, including the existential contention that death made brothers of all men. Jessie now knew the truth was that love made brothers and sisters of all people. As different as they were, love was that common defining ground, making everyone the same giddy, delirious fools for it in 1,001 ways. Like countless women before her, From tender teens to wise seniors welcoming a second wind, Jessie began keeping a diary to forever capture her memories.
Memory, day 13. Today we kissed in all 157 rooms in the castle, including closets, utility rooms, and bathrooms. Memory, day 12. We had a midnight picnic of smoked salmon and cheeses and 3 bottles of wine. My aching head, on the castle grounds beneath the star-drenched sky. And while everyone else slept, we swam nude in the garden fountain and made love on all 3 tiers. Memory, day 11. We chased the cooks from the kitchen and made chocolate chip pancakes with raspberry jam and whipped cream.
What they'd done with that raspberry jam and whipped cream had had very little to do with eating. The pancakes, that was. But not all of the memories were good. She couldn't hide in some of the memories. Some of them slapped her in the face with truth.
Memory, day 10. Lucan Trevain came today.
Lucan stood at the line of demarcation between Keltar-warded land and Trevain-warded land, staring up at the castle. He towed arrogantly up to it, though he didn't care for the feeling at all. The Keltar's power hummed in the earth beneath his feet, trying to push past the invisible boundary, butting up against his own wards. It had taken him all night and the efforts of a dozen well-trained men to secure this portion of land, enough for him to accomplish his aims. By the light of a pale moon, while the castle slept, they'd spelled the soil, from the sleek black limousine readied behind him for a swift departure, up to the circle of estate Kian had claimed for himself. Now he stood approximately 200 yards from the castle proper, waiting. The Highlander hadn't wasted time and resources warding more than the immediate grounds, nor had there been any reason to. Lucan was effectively barred from the castle by this meager yet insurmountable perimeter, as Kian had known he would be. So long as he did not cross that boundary, Kian couldn't use sorcery on him. So long as Kian did not cross it, Lucan couldn't use sorcery on him either. As they were both immortal and self-healing, they couldn't harm each other with anything else. They'd mastered long ago the exact wards that neutralized the other's power. This was the only way reclusive sorcerers were ever willing to meet, toe-to-toe on neutralized ground. Kian would not cross the line, nor would Lucan, unless a temper could be provoked, and they were both too smart for that. Though he was immortal and could not be physically slain, he could be bespelled. If he were fool enough to stray onto Kian's warded ground, the Highlander could trap him and cocoon him in a mystic stasis, as helpless as a fly in a thick, sticky spider's web. Eventually, Lucan might figure out how to break free, but he had very little time left to take chances with. And he'd never been willing to wager on the outcome of a battle of spells between him and the Highlander. The situation at this second castle, Keltar, was far worse than he'd imagined. He could feel the potency of 2 Keltar druids in this new castle, about whom he knew nothing but for this. Their power was as old as their names. They were strong. Not like Kian, but also not like any other druid he'd ever encountered. He'd arrived yesterday afternoon and swiftly gotten the lay of the land. There was no way he was going to be able to get inside that castle without help. Which was why they'd spent the night warding, why he was standing here now. His wits would have to serve him again, as they had so well 1133 years ago.
Trevain.
Kian's nostrils flared as he spat the word.
Keltar.
Lucan spat it back, as though the vilest of vials had passed across his tongue, a tongue so heavily tattooed it was blackened with dye. That tongue had spoken such sordid spells and lies that it should have rotted from the dark sorcerer's mouth, as his soul had rotted from his body so long ago.
"You don't look ready to die to me,"
Lucan taunted. Kian laughed softly.
"I've been ready to die for over 1,000 years, Trevain."
"Really?"
"I have pictures of your woman. She looks like quite the fuck. I'm going to find out once the tithe is paid." The tithe will never be paid, Trevane. You're going to watch us together, Highlander. I'll push her up against your mirror and...
Kian turned around and began walking back toward the castle.
You waste my time, Trevane.
Why did you come out then, Keltar?
Kian turned around, walked back to the line and towed it. He stood so close that their noses nearly touched. The width of a hair kept them separate and safe from each other, no more. Lucan saw movement behind the Highlander. The woman had just stepped out onto the top stair of the elaborate stone entryway, precisely as he'd hoped.
"To look into your eyes, Lucan," Kian said softly, "and see death there. And I saw it."
He turned sharply again, heading for the castle. He looked up at the entrance.
"Go back inside the castle, Jessica, now!"
he called sharply, seeing her on the stairs.
"What does she think of all this, Kelta?"
Lucan called after him, making his voice loud enough to carry clearly to her ears as well.
"Is she as eager for vengeance as you?"
Kian made no reply.
"Tell me, is she as ready for you to die as you are, Highlander?"
Lucan called. Kian broke into a sprint toward the stairs.
"I don't believe you want to die, Keltar!"
Lucan yelled after him.
"I know I don't. In fact, I'd do virtually anything to stay alive. I think I'd agree to anything at all to pass that tide through the dark glass at midnight on Samhain."
His voice rang out, carrying clearly across the lawn, echoing off the stone walls of the castle. Kian reached the stairs and loped up them. Turning Jessica by her shoulders, he steered her back in the castle and closed the door behind them. Lucan didn't care. He'd accomplished what he'd come for. His final words had not been meant for the Keltar at all. They'd been meant for the woman who'd stood on the steps so foolishly betraying her emotions, her hands anxiously fisted, her eyes deep with grief. It would take time. He had no doubt it would take more days than he would bear well, and others would die, victims of his displeasure in the interim. Though he could not read her, in fact had smashed up against that strange, smooth barrier once again, he'd read her body. There was no greater fool than a woman in love.
"Think on that, Jessica St. James," he whispered, "and let it begin to eat away inside you."
Many hours later, long after Lucan Trevane had gotten back in his sleek, black-windowed black limousine and gone, Jessie sat staring at the computer screen in the darkened library. She pressed her palms to the cool surface of the small library table beneath the softly illuminated portrait of an 18th-century MacKeltar patriarch and his wife, keeping her hands well away from the keyboard and the mouse. It was 4 o'clock in the morning, and the castle was silent as a tomb. It had begun to feel like one to her, too. She hadn't been the only one affected by the dark sorcerer's visit earlier in the day. It had cast a somber pall over all the MacKelters. Kian alone had been grimly satisfied by it.
"He comes begging. He knows I've won,"
he'd told her. Won her ass. Dying was not winning, not in her book. Lucan Trevane was evil. He was the one who should die, not Kian. She raked a hand through her curls, staring at the display. Lucan Trevane was, in fact, utterly terrifying. She'd had no idea what to expect of Kian's ancient enemy, but even if he'd warned her, nothing could have prepared her for what she'd seen. He hadn't even looked human. The plate in her head that shielded her from compulsion and deep listening indeed shielded her from all magic. For while Gwen and Chloe had seen nothing more than a handsome man in his 40s, Jesse'd seen the dark sorcerer's true appearance. He'd been so heavily tattooed that his skin had appeared rotted in places. He'd moved with sickening reptilian stealth. His eyes, if they could be called that, had been fiery crimson slits. His tongue had flickered blackly as he'd spoken. But far worse than his grotesque appearance had been the chill and suffocating sense of pure evil that had emanated from him, even from so far across the lawn. not so far that she hadn't been able to clearly hear every word he'd said. She'd tried to stay in the castle as Kian had ordered, but when they'd gone toe-to-toe, when she'd seen her man facing off with that twisted thing out there on the lawn, she'd burst from the castle, unable to stop herself. Her every instinct had demanded she do something, anything to help Kian, though she'd known there was nothing she could hope to do. Not against something like Trevane. At that moment, she'd understood much of Kian's conviction. It wasn't just horrific evil that rolled off the ancient sorcerer. It was horrific power, too. Not nearly as great as Kian's, but now that she'd seen him with her own eyes, she had to concede the possibility that once Trevane had the aid of the Dark Book, he might genuinely be unstoppable. "I think I'd agree to anything at all to pass that tithe through the dark glass at midnight on Samhain," the sorcerer had said. Jessie wasn't stupid. She knew he'd been baiting her. Problem was, he had the right stuff on his hook. Kian's life. She buried her face in her hands, massaging her temples. The instant he'd said it, some terrible, weak